more strategically than you would have been otherwise. And we've actually saved more energy through energy efficiency efforts in Europe than any single source of energy supply since the 1970s. The second intervention is to invest in grids. They don't sound very attractive. You want to invest in energy supply or maybe energy storage or other things like solar and wind, and the grid is perpetually uninvested in or underinvested in. And it isn't just the transmission grid, also local distribution grids. And even though it's 2025, you still have situations where people go to charge their Tesla and they cause a grid outage because those distribution grids just aren't up to par. And lastly, and I'm a huge fan of proponent of this, is invest in energy supply that is more distributed. We call this distributed generation or prosuming, where you put solar panels, wind, hydro, biogas, and other interventions close to your home or your factory or your hospital or your building.
Are we looking at more of this happening more often?
Absolutely. So the two metrics people often use to measure power outages are frequency and duration. Kind of frequency is how often they happen. Duration is how intensive they are. Do they last for an hour or a minute or days or weeks? And unfortunately, we're seeing increases in both the frequency and duration of blackouts. And climate change is actually aggravating both of them as well. The hotter it gets, and as the more severe storms there are, the more severe wind events there are, the harder it is for electricity networks to deliver kilowatt hours or electrons to your home. And those are set to get almost twice as worse in the next 15 years, and potentially three times as worse by the end of the century. So I think we have this perfect storm brewing. We need electrification to solve climate change, but climate change is only making electricity systems far more vulnerable to disruption.
Finally, I've covered heat and blackout extensively with this program. For example, check out the show Heat Up, Grid Down, posted May 26, 2021. In the blog for that show, I listed out 12 reasons electric grids may fail as the climate heats up. And here they are, for the first time on radio. Number 1, a concurrent solar storm. The U.S. grid is poorly protected against an EMP event, an electromagnetic pulse. Number 2, super demand from all those air conditioners and AC, and particularly heat pumps, cannot keep up past certain temperatures, so people keep them going full blast. Number 3, electric companies in California shut down the grid when there's a high wildfire risk, as they did in September 2019 during a heat wave. My local power company here in British Columbia said, yeah, they're just going to shut down if it gets hot and dry. Number 4, a concurrent drought may reduce available hydroelectric power. Number 5, too hot cooling water can shut down nuclear plants and coal plants too. Number 6, the grid works less efficiently and is more fragile during high heat. Number 7, concurrent terrorist attack or misguided social protest could break the grid at the same time during a heat wave. Number 8, concurrent wildfires burn down key transmission or production facilities as climate change increases. Number 9, heat sag is the major cause of transmission bottlenecks that result in brownouts and blackouts. That happens during the heat. We get more heat. Number 10, technical weakness within power lines during high heat, and I've got more during that program with an expert called Ray Klumpf about that. Number 11, very high temperatures also make it dangerous for outdoor workers like power maintenance people to do their job when the grid is threatened or goes down. And number 12, climate change denial is often strong in places where the risk of grid heat and failure are the greatest, like in Texas and Arizona. That leads to inaction and lack of public planning, and then poor care of people when it does get too hot. That's it from Alex Smith, 12 Reasons from my Radio EcoShock show, Heat Up, Grid Down, Why the Grid Could Fail as Climate Change Increases.
Radio EcoShock.
Earth has been much hotter in the distant past. Before the asteroid strike 66 million years ago, this planet went through 80 million years more or less as a greenhouse world. There was no ice at the poles and sea level was hundreds of feet higher than today. That was the Cretaceous period. Within that, though, scientists are now finding signs of a time with similar sea surface temperatures as today and ice at the poles. Can we learn from that transition to understand the future? Will global warming make an ice-free world again? Dr. Robert Spicer is Emeritus Professor of Earth Sciences at Open University in the UK and currently a visiting professor at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. Dr. Spicer is co-author of the new paper, Back to an Ice-Free Future, Early Cretaceous Seasonal Cycles of Sea Surface Temperature and Glacier Ice. We find them in southern China. From China, Robert Spicer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
It has been 18 years since we last spoke, and you explained how fossil leaf patterns reveal clues about the atmosphere and climate in distant times. We talked about the Cretaceous. Have you been studying deep time ever since, Robert?
Yes, I have. When we last spoke, I think most of my research was focused on the Arctic and how in the Cretaceous, the near polar regions of northern Alaska, it was closer to the pole then, hosted diverse forests with dinosaurs running around. That was in the Maastrichtian. Since then, I've been doing a lot of work combining looking at the fossil record with numerical climate modeling with my colleagues at Bristol University in the UK. And since about 1995, I also started an interest in looking at how we can use plant fossils to tell past surface heights, in particular the growth of the Tibetan Plateau and surrounding mountains, and how those have influenced the development of the monsoon. Right now I'm in Sichuanbana Tropical Botanical Garden in southernmost China near Myanmar and Laos, and our monsoon started 2 days ago. We've had months of dryness, and now it rains pretty much every day.
Has it been hot lately?
It was when I first arrived. Now it's cooled down, and the monsoon has arrived more or less on schedule. About 2 weeks ago, the local Dai people had their water festival, and this is at the end of the dry season in anticipation of the onset of the monsoon. And now here we are. It's raining. Yesterday was torrential rain. And the Earth system, so far, in this part of the world, is behaving as we expect.
So was the Cretaceous generally hotter than now? Was it a greenhouse world?
Yes, it was. The hottest part of the Cretaceous was around the middle of the Cretaceous, let's say 100 million years ago. And during the late Cretaceous, temperatures gradually declined through to the Maastrichtian. And, of course, at the end of the Maastrichtian, that's when we have the demise of the dinosaurs. So there's an awful lot of debate about whether the dinosaur and other biota were being stressed by what we know was a very variable climate regime in that cool interval. But the focus of this work, and I need to correct you slightly, the material that we use for this actually came from Madagascar, but were analyzed in China. The material for this work is focused at a much earlier time, the early part of the Cretaceous, 133 million years ago, in what is called the Valanginian. Now, at that time, there was an event, a global event called the Wissert event, and this is named after Helmut Wissert, who first detected it. And basically, it's a sudden drawdown of atmospheric carbon. So carbon is being sucked out of the atmosphere. Normally, in ocean systems, we see that as a dark layer in ocean sediments. We call it an anoxic event, where the bottom of the ocean lacks oxygen, and so the carbon is preserved. Well, on this occasion, there really isn't so much of that, but what there is on land is the development of a lot of coal. So we think perhaps the carbon drawdown was associated with something going on land rather than in the ocean. The drawdown of the CO2 led to a reduction in temperature. And when we look around the world, particularly at higher latitudes, we see evidence of ice in the form of things called drop stones, which are ordinary stones that are rafted out into the ocean on ice sheets. The ice melts and the stones end up in anomalous positions within the sediments. There are deposits called chillites, which are produced by glaciers. There's a number of temperature readings that we can get from proxies in the ocean that suggest cool conditions, and something called glendonites, which is a mineral that only forms in cold conditions, less than plus 5 degrees Celsius. All of these suggest that the Vissert event was associated with some degree of ice, particularly at high latitudes. And so what we've been trying to do is look at the oysters that are found in northern Madagascar. And these oysters are found by Dr. Hasina Narina Ranjanali from the Antananarivo University in Madagascar. And she met up with the lead author of this paper called Herson Lin, who had just finished his PhD at the time. He was working at the Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research, which I'm affiliated with. And he got excited about the fact that he saw in this material a series of very well-defined growth rings. Now, oysters put more shell on each year, and so their growth is expressed in rings pretty much like you see in trees. And these rings were beautifully preserved, and he thought maybe he could analyze these rings for their constituent minerals, and in particular, what we call clumped isotopes, that will record a temperature signal. And that's what he did. I mean, what he did was really quite extraordinary. He used a micro drill to remove very, very small pieces of shell, 0.5 millimeters apart. So there's 20 of these samples in a centimeter. And it was able to analyze these for the carbon-13 and oxygen-18 bonds within the calcite. Now, the ratio of those, or the amount of those linked bonds of carbon-13 and oxygen-18, which are slightly heavier versions of the normal carbon-12, oxygen-16, the amount of that dual bonding in the calcite is directly related to the temperature at which the calcite was formed, the mineral, the carbonate mineral of the shell. And as a consequence, he was able to extract not just mean signals of the temperature in the ocean in northern Madagascar, but seasonal variations at this time in the past.
Were the seasons more variable during this period?
Well, what's remarkable is that if you look at the rest of the Cretaceous, it clearly is a warm world. Where, as I said before, we've got forest at the poles and all this kind of thing. And the seasonal variation is different to now. What is captured in these oyster shells is that 133 million years ago, during this cool event, the seasons are just, or seasonal surface temperatures of the ocean were exactly as we see today. What's also captured in the chemistry of these shells are indications of things like salinity and the composition of seawater. And again, they are very similar to what we see today. So the idea that emerged from this finding is that this cool interval in the Cretaceous probably is a good analog for where we are heading in the very, very near future as we continue to warm the planet. It's worth bearing in mind that the calculations that you can do from the composition of the seawater and the shells is that the ice fields in the polar regions were maybe half what they are today. Sea level might have been as much as 60 meters higher than the present, and we would have a very strong oscillation between winter and summer as the seasons, where the ice builds up in the polar winter, whichever hemisphere it is, and then melts again in the summer. So there's big oscillation in ice field development at each pole as each year goes on. An unstable, if you like, situation, And bearing in mind that these kinds of seasonal oscillations have profound effect on the way that the climate system overall operates, we propose that this time in the past is a good one to use to get real-world information of how the world may well respond, possibly in the next few centuries.
Yes, this was a new idea to me, that Earth may not go straight from current polar ice caps to ice-free, but might first encounter a long period where ice forms on Greenland during the winter and Antarctica during the summer, like alternating polar ice caps, as you just discussed. That seems like a different version, and we might run into it.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the Antarctica, for example, is one big ice cube, and it takes a lot of energy to melt that ice. So the oscillations that may have been expressed in this past time are less pronounced in the modern world because the temperature, particularly in the southern, is buffered by the big southern ice cap. Now, as that melts, there is less buffering. And in the Arctic, of course, the ice is melting much, much faster than it is in Antarctica. And so the northern hemisphere may well suffer these big oscillations, seasonal oscillations, long before Antarctica does. And we've tested these ideas using numerical climate models. And what was really gratifying is that the climate models were able to reproduce extremely well the kind of signals that we see in the oysters. So we're able to get the climate model to fractionate isotopes in the same way as they do in reality. And what we see is everything that we interpret from the proxies reflected in the numerical climate model. The advantage of the model is that we can test out ideas that go beyond the particular location we're looking at or the spotty, incomplete data that we have in the geological record, and we can build a much more complete picture of the world back then and also understand the processes that underlie it. And if you run such climate models, what you do see is this big seasonal switch from pole to pole with the development of significant amounts of snow. In the climate models, the snow tends to run throughout the year. In other words, it can accumulate at the kind of carbon dioxide levels that we are heading to very quickly. In other words, 2 times pre-industrial, or 560 parts per million by volume. And this is our future. In a few decades' time, we will be there. And under those conditions, back in the Valanginian, we can see that the climate model is telling us that the general interpretation of the rock patterns is right. And now we can go elsewhere in the Valanginian and see in the real world exactly how the Earth system responded to those conditions.
Bob Spicer, tell us about your work in China.
In relation to this particular study, it exploits the wonderful facilities that they have at the Institute of Tibetan Plateau Research. There's vast rooms full of mass spectrometers that can do very fancy analyses, and a wonderful body of expertise there. My particular interest in working in China at the moment is to refine our techniques for measuring past surface height. As I mentioned to you before, a lot of my work in recent years has been focused in the Tibetan region, what we call the Pan-Tibetan Highlands, that include the plateau and the Himalaya and the Hengrun Mountains. And I've been developing techniques based on leaf architecture or leaf form that can tell us reasonably accurately how high mountains were or plateau were in the past. The principle of one technique is based on conservation of energy. And in a nutshell, plant leaves are able to capture a property of the atmosphere known as moist enthalpy, which is a function of temperature. and moisture, two things plants are really interested in. So unsurprisingly, the leaf form, the population of plants in a given area, tend to reflect those conditions in the atmosphere. Now, using moist enthalpy, we can determine surface height. And it's a very simple relationship. If you measure moist enthalpy at sea level, and we've got lots of fossil assemblages at sea level that can provide this, and when we don't have the fossils, we can use, again, the climate models to obtain moist enthalpy at sea level. And we find the fossil assemblage, let's say, on the Tibetan Plateau. We analyze that fossil assemblage, and we can determine the moist enthalpy then. And if we know the date and that we're dealing with, and we know that we've got sea level floras of the same age, the difference in moist enthalpy between those two fossil assemblages, divided by the acceleration due to gravity, which is a constant through time, gives us the height difference. And using that, we've been able to, in the last 10 years or so, completely overturn our ideas about the growth of the Tibetan Plateau. Originally, it was thought that, you know, India comes in from the south and collides with Asia, and that basically plowing into Asia caused the Asian crust to rise and form the modern plateau. We now know from these kinds of techniques that the landscape prior to the arrival of India was much more complicated. We have, instead of the Himalaya, we have a mountain range running east-west along the southern margin of Eurasia called the Gangdese Arc. North of that is a wide, deep valley with subtropical vegetation. We've called it Shangri-La vegetation because it's a hidden valley in Tibet after the novel Lost Horizon that was made into a movie by Hollywood in the 1930s. And then north of that, there is another mountain range called the Changtang mountain range, caused by an earlier collision of what is now the southern part of the Tibetan Plateau with Eurasia. That earlier collision occurred in the late Jurassic, early Cretaceous, the time we've just been talking about with the oysters. And then, of course, India comes along and starts colliding probably around 65 million years ago. The result of the Indian collision is that we get the Changtang terrain extruded to the east. That raises eastern Tibet. That, using climate models, we can tell that generates an increase in rainfall. Gradually, we get the central Tibetan Valley rises moving towards the west. We get the plateau at around 23 million years. The modern plateau is formed. That again changes all the climate. And around 15 million years, we have the Himalaya reaching the height of the then plateau and the present plateau. And then after that, the Himalaya builds a big southern wall, Tibet dries out, and we get the modern monsoon. So is that an answer to your question?
It certainly is. You are a time traveler, and it's always interesting to talk with you because I learn things I just never knew before. As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
You mentioned I'm a time traveler. I suppose I am, in a way. I spent all my career thinking about deep time and what it's like to live there. And I would just leave you with this. Back in 2017, I was approached by the BBC to join a project that was going to make a wildlife documentary with Sir David Attenborough doing the voiceover. Just like the blue chip wildlife documentaries called Blue Planet and Life on Earth and this kind of thing. The only difference was it was going to be set 66 million years ago. And for somebody who spends his entire life thinking what it was like back then, this was a dream come true. So I would encourage anyone out there who is at all interested in fossils to look at the wonderful animations that there now are in the form of Prehistoric Planet, which is on Apple TV, and to get thinking about our world of the past, because that world of the past, unlike the climate models, tells us just how quickly the Earth can respond to perturbations. And one thing we have learned is that ice sheets can respond remarkably fast to warming. And that personally worries me, because I think at the moment we are underestimating what the future will be like in the not-so-distant future. I mean decades and the next century. So do take climate change very seriously. We've seen it happen in the past without human interference. Our human interference is just turbocharging the whole process and, in a sense, taking us back to the future.
From southern China, we've been talking with Professor Emeritus Robert Spicer, and you can find links to all the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Bob Spicer, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Be blackout ready. Get some candles and a battery-operated radio. Keep extra food at home. Have plenty of water around. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world. And we finish off with some excellent reporting from CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Network. They call it Hell on Earth in Houston. After Hurricane Beryl roared over, a million people in Houston lost power for 5 days. About 3 days after the storm, the heat index went above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38 C. That's the danger time. And there was no air conditioning. Here it is from CBC, July 2nd, 2024.
Right now in Texas, roads are littered with debris. People are struggling to find food that hasn't gone bad. Hospitals are diverting patients to an NFL stadium. And in some places, the line to fill up your tank is hours long.
It is, you know, hell on earth here in Houston.
This all started when Hurricane Beryl made landfall on Monday. But Texas is no stranger to storms, even hurricanes. It's really what happened next that made things go from bad to miserable. Shortly after Beryl made landfall, 2.7 million people in Texas lost power. Now, 5 days later, about a million people are still in the dark. The vast majority of them are in Houston. 5 days is enough time for pretty much all the food in your fridge to go bad. And such a widespread outage means a ton of grocery stores and restaurants lost power too.
Distribution sites becoming a hotspot for people in need of food and water.
Some people are relying on generators to keep things running. But most generators run on gas. And right now, gas stations in Houston are either closed or completely swamped. Less than a day after Beryl made landfall, temperatures in Texas started climbing. By midweek, the heat index, which rates how it feels outside, was above 100 degrees in some areas. That's 38 degrees Celsius.
Meteorologists have the record-setting triple-digit heat wave continuing from Texas up through the western U.S. until week's end.
True, it is really hot. So I have my temperature gauge right here. 122, that's how hot the cement feels.
The National Weather Service warned this could be dangerous because if you're stuck in that kind of heat without any let-up, without any AC, sunstroke, heat cramps, and heat exhaustion are all very real possibilities.
This is a tall building. We're told the generator here went out yesterday, and people in their 80s and 90s live here. They're having to take the stairs to get to and from their apartments. It's so hot. It's so muggy. Some people still can't even get around their neighborhoods because of all of these downed trees.
We've got a portable fan that is chargeable, battery operated, so that helped last night, but we won't probably stay another night.
That's right. It's gotten so hard to sleep, they're actually leaving their homes in search of a cooler place to rest. And while there are public cooling centers open, very few are open past 9. And just look at Expedia. There are a couple of rooms available, but almost every hotel in Houston was either sold out or closed on Thursday night. This combination of heat and no AC has left hospitals overwhelmed too.
We have a backup in our hospitals because they can't discharge patients because patients can't go home if they don't have power.
At one point, according to the lieutenant governor, hospitals were so backed up, ambulances were waiting 3 hours just to drop off their patients. The city has since opened a sports arena to help with the overflow. When all of this is finally over, someone needs to figure out why these outages dragged on for so long and how to stop it from happening again.
That report, Hell on Earth in Houston, is from July 2024 from CBC Radio Canada.